Welcome to Declaring Independence, a show dedicated to the idea that if two people are thinking exactly alike on everything, one of them probably isn't thinking at all. Here's your host, Ed Brayton.
Hey, good evening. Declaring Independence here on Public Reality Radio, WPRR, 1680 AM and 95.3 FM in Grand Rapids. Ed Brayton here, as always. And this is the place where I would usually introduce my producer and co-host, Jeremy, but he is off in the woods camping this week, presumably getting eaten by bugs and doing without all of the privileges of civilization. So in his place, we have the station manager here at WPRR, also Jeremy's co-host for the Reasonable Doubts podcast and the star of stage and screen in his own right, Dave Fletcher. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm just fine. Are you a camping guy?
No.
Yeah, I'm not either.
No, dear heavens, no.
Yeah, I know. Jeremy, I'm always laughing at him because he and Jennifer are always wandering off into the woods.
I don't get it.
No, I am so not the rugged outdoorsy type. And I've had, like, every bad thing imaginable that could happen while camping has happened to me. Yeah, like, I've had, I mean, bears,
see, now,
poison
ivy. The great way to avoid stuff like that is to not go outside,
right,
which is my chosen course.
Exactly. Yeah. I've reached that point after a childhood of camping in which every bad thing, and finally at about, I was probably 25 or 26, and I was camping with a girlfriend. We were camping down at Warren Dunes.
Yeah.
And we had a tornado hit the campground.
Whoa.
And that was pretty much the last straw.
I was going to say,
all right, I'm
it.
Done. Mother Nature, you stay on your side of the world, I'll stay on.
That's right.
I watched the nature on the Discovery Channel the way God intended it.
That sounds about right.
Me and nature do not get along. I'll camp at the Hilton. Thank you very much. So did you see this weird news item this week? The New York Times reported that Lou Gehrig may not have died of Lou Gehrig's disease.
What?
Yeah.
No, I did not see this.
Apparently, there's research that shows that getting hit in the head, like head trauma, which he took balls to the head several times during his career.
Yes.
That can mimic the effects of a myotrophic lateral sclerosis.
ALS,
So they said it's entirely possible, they said, that Lou Gehrig did not die of Lou Gehrig's disease, which I'm just like unhinged from reality at this point.
Yeah.
Like, this is nihilism on the way. If you can't count on that.
Right.
I mean, what's next? Right? Yeah. I mean, are you going to tell me that Grant's not buried in Grant's tomb? That all those kids aren't really Jerry's? What? This just has me completely freaked out.
That's disturbing. That's, everything I know is wrong.
Exactly. It just makes you question if that's not true, what is,
Right.
There's a great comedian, a guy named Tony V, one of the guys from that Boston comedy scene that launched so many great careers, Stephen Wright and all those guys, who used to end his act with one of the funniest lines I've ever heard. He would end his act by saying, he said, in closing, I just want to leave you with this thought, which is question everything with one exception. Never look inside a tuna belt. There are some things you're just better off taking on faith, which I just thought was a brilliant way to end an act. Anyway, what's going on in the news these days?
Well, I don't know if you've heard of this, but there's a proposed mosque near Ground Zero.
Really? Yeah. No, I hadn't heard of that at all.
It's funny. It's making the rounds. Some people have mentioned it.
Yeah. We've been on this for 4 weeks now.
Yeah.
Because it's just – it won't stop.
No. And it just gets more and more crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, there's this, and I personally, let me just say, it's not a mosque, it's an Islamic center. There's a prayer room. Quit calling it a mosque.
Anyway. It's like a YMCA, really.
Essentially, yes. But
which, the village people are going to freak out about. I'm just saying. It's just not going to go over well. Actually, there's only one village. There's like one. It's a village person now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's kind of sad. You see the concerts. He's got the Indian headdress and the tulle belt and the chaps. It's
And he's just doing M.
Yeah.
It's tragic. Tragic. Well, President Obama, of course, has commented about the mosque, and this was at a dinner at the White House celebrating the beginning of Ramadan,
right.
Because he's a Muslim.
Right. Although Bush did the same thing.
Bush did the same thing.
It's a long tradition.
Of course, yes. And he said, let me be clear. As a citizen and as president, I believe that Muslims have the same right to practice their religion as anyone else in this country. That includes the right to build a place of worship and a community center on private property in Lower Manhattan in accordance with local laws and ordinances. This is America, and our commitment to religious freedom must be unshakable. The principle that people of all faiths are welcome in this country and will not be treated differently by their government is essential to who we are. The writ of our founders must endure.
And he's right.
Case closed.
Absolutely right.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, then he took a little criticism. He kind of seemed to back off it a little bit. And he said that he wasn't commenting on whether it's a good idea to put it there, only on the legality of it. But at least he stood up for the legality of the mask, which is, or the mosque, which is, you know, I'll give him credit for that. But I frankly wish he had gone much further. I think he should have just attacked the demagoguery that's coming from the right on this issue and pointed out that not only is it like absurd and disingenuous, but it hurts our national security.
Yes.
That those right-wingers who claim that it's the left that are undermining the war on terror, on terrorism, are actually weakening our ability to fight Islamic extremism and playing into the narrative that al-Qaeda wants the rest of the Muslim world to get, which is that the United States is at war with all of Islam.
We're a Christian nation. We hate Islam. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the narrative they've been trying to sell for years. We're making it. We're feeding into their recruiting pitch with this kind of behavior. And I think that I wish that President Obama had gone right in the attack on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, President Bush – how crazy is this? We're now looking at President Bush as like the reasonable elder statesman of the Republican Party. But when he was in office, he was very careful. I mean, he understood the danger of that kind of narrative. And he was very careful to say that, listen, most Muslims in the world are peaceful, moderate people. We're only at war with the most extreme elements, the truly violent ones. Now the Republican leadership has reversed that position and is engaged in wholesale demonization.
Mm-hmm.
Of Muslims because that kind of emotionalism sells to their base.
Right.
And they think this will help them regain power, which means that essentially they are selling out the country's national security for their own short-term political benefit.
Right.
And I got a real problem with that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they're also demeaning. I mean, the fact is that moderate Muslims are indispensable in this fight.
Right.
There are thousands and thousands of them working for the FBI, the CIA, the military. They're acting. They're in the war zones in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're acting as translators.
Yes.
They're interpreting millions of intercepted messages from abroad every day. They're training our officers in how to understand the Muslim world, including the leader of this mosque.
Right.
Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf works with the FBI.
Right.
And the State Department and trains our people in counterterrorism.
This is not some jihadist.
No. And so, you know, they are demeaning those people who are loyal to the United States and fighting and, I mean, risking their lives on a daily basis to protect us. And it's just – it's appalling what they're doing. And, you know, you look at the one thing that they've dragged out that's like trying to discredit Rauf is that he said after 9/11 in an interview that American policy – in the Middle East has helped fuel this.
Yes.
Well, he's right.
He's absolutely right.
He's absolutely right in this. And no, I mean, Glenn Beck said the same thing. Glenn Beck said it just a few months ago, was saying that, listen, our support for dictators in the Middle East doesn't help us here.
Right.
We are creating the conditions for people to be recruitable in this. I mean, in 1953, we took the only democratically elected man that Iran had ever had, Mohammad Mossadegh. We overthrew him. Mm-hmm. We put the Shah in power, a brutal dictator with a secret police force that did horrible things to people. And we propped him up on top of a mountain of American aid and weapons for 25 years and looked the other way while he brutalized his people. And then when they overthrew him, they hated the United States. Well, gee, I wonder why.
We have a very bad track record in the Middle East. Saddam Hussein had U.S. support.
We put him in power. We kept him in power. We gave him the chemical weapons that he used to kill his own people and hundreds of thousands of Iranian people. I mean, we have a horrible track record here. It's no one. I mean, the fact is, turn the tables. If we're on the other end of that, we're going to hate us too.
Absolutely.
And so if we would stop violating our own principles in foreign policy, maybe we'd find that we make fewer enemies.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so what he said was absolutely correct. And the whole thing is just there's so many elements to this that infuriate me.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about this earlier, you and I off the air.
Right.
Hallowed ground.
Yeah.
It's a sacred ground.
Well, because the building in question was hit by one of the wheels.
The engine. Well, the engine of one of the planes fell through the roof.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's sacred ground. It's been touched by the wreckage.
There wasn't a building anywhere around there that didn't take some.
Right.
Yeah, it didn't take some.
And the debris
damage.
In the air covered all of Manhattan and, you know, eventually the entire world. So it's all hallowed ground.
The New York Daily News did a little tour of the, like, two blocks. This is about two blocks.
Right.
You can't even see Ground Zero from there.
No.
I mean, you just face it, these are huge buildings all
yes,
the way around here.
Of course.
I've been there. I've driven around there. You can't even see it. It's in the shadow of Ground Zero. No, it's not. You can't even see
well,
it from
to
there.
Be fair, when the towers were there, everything was in their shadow.
Yeah.
They were the biggest things in the in the city.
But so the New York Daily News does a little tour of a two-block radius in every direction.
Yes.
And practically next door to Ground Zero is the Thunder Lingerie and Peep Show. In the window of this place is a huge American flag. And it's over
as
the top
there
of,
should be.
As there should be, over the top of a big supply of sex toys. Sacred ground indeed.
Yes, you know? Very much so. Yeah.
And here's the craziest argument I keep hearing on this issue. I wrote about this on my blog this morning. I've seen several of the wing nuts who are against this thing make this argument. This isn't about religious freedom.
Oh,
this
no.
is about the feelings of the families of 9/11.
Yes.
And the feelings are understandable. I'm not
sure.
You have a right to feel what you feel and say
Absolutely.
What you want to say. But to pretend that this isn't about religious freedom, the right to put up a place of worship, what could,
right.
I mean, how, what is, if that's not an issue of religious freedom, what could be?
And I'm sorry, I didn't realize that there were no innocent Muslims killed on 9/11.
Right.
I didn't realize
dozens
that.
Of them
yeah.
killed in 9/11.
Yes.
And like I said, thousands of them every day risking their lives to
yes.
fight against those people that
Absolutely.
Perpetrated 9/11. And yet we want to pretend they're all the same. It's
right.
it's incredible.
Right.
And there is a grand irony at work here. And I've been writing about this for weeks, and finally I saw the mainstream media pick up on this. Dave Weigel picked up on this in Slate the other day.
Yeah.
There is an irony at the center of this, which is that one of the reasons why they've not been able to get any legal recourse in this
mm-hmm.
is a law passed in 2000 called the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, or RLUIPA.
Mm-hmm.
This was a bill that was passed by a Republican-led Congress in 2000 that provides exemptions from zoning regulations for religious groups. If any local law, any generally applicable law, zoning regulation, or so forth has an impact on someone's religious freedom, they can go to court and get an exemption from that. Now, in this case, they don't even need that exemption.
No.
In this case, they are totally in compliance
right.
with all of the local laws. But that law gives them practically yeah. carte blanche to do whatever they want. And that's a law that the religious right loves and supports.
Right.
And, you know, they demand exemptions from the laws that apply to every other kind of building.
Right.
But now when the Muslims are in compliance with all the local regulations, they still want it stopped.
Right. If it were a Christian church, we wouldn't be hearing anything about
no,
it. In
of
fact,
course.
There are a number of churches right by by Ground Zero
lots
as well.
Of them, right. Yes. Hindu temples, the whole nine yards.
Yes. Even Rush Limbaugh's Hindu temple
yeah.
in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Would we put a Hindu temple at Pearl Harbor? Hindu temple?
Yeah, this
really?
Is, yeah.
The
Hindu the Japanese were Hindus.
Yeah.
yeah,
okay.
Here's the best thing. This came out this morning. There's a British website, a satirical website called the Daily Mash. And this morning they had a brilliant parody of the whole thing. And it said, starts out, plans to build a state-of-the-art library next to Republican catastrophe Sarah Palin are causing outrage across mainstream America. Campaigners have described the project as insensitive and a deliberate act of provocation by people with brains. Bill McKay, a leading member of the right-wing Teapot Movement, said, quote, Sarah Palin is a hallowed place for Americans who can't read. How is she going to feel knowing that every day there are people going inside a building to find things out for themselves and have thoughts right in the very shadow of her home? He added, our founding fathers intended for every building in this country to be a church containing one book written by Jesus that would be read out in a strange voice by an orange man in a shiny suit who would also tell you you were allowed to kill. Building a library next to Miss Palin is like Pearl Harbor or 9/11. That's brilliant.
That's great.
That's a great
theory. And can I just say how much I appreciate that people in the UK know enough about our politicians to do satire, whereas we couldn't do anything
no.
like that.
No. And that includes me, honestly.
Oh,
God.
Me too.
If you ask me, I mean, I think the guy in charge now is David Cameron.
Gordon Brown.
No, he's done.
Yeah,
got,
he's
I
done.
Think it's
yeah,
now David Cameron.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we are far too ignorant about
right.
the rest of the world.
And I know in France, their prime minister is short.
Yeah,
Sarkozy.
Yeah. And he dates models or something.
Yeah, he's married to a model who's tall.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
International politics.
Yeah, this is, we just demonstrated the whole ugly American exactly. premise right here. Yep. Let's take a break. Let's go to some public service announcements. We'll be right back with James Hanley. My guest tonight is James Hanley. James is a professor of political science at Adrian University and a frequent commenter on my blog, which is how I got to know him. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ed.
You are a political scientist who also teaches research methods.
Correct.
And I was once upon a time a political science student. I wonder, from your perspective, if some of the sort of classic truisms of political science remain true, or if they ever really were. It's just sort of, you know, stretching my memory back 25 years, or 23 or 24 years anyway, to some of the things that I learned. I mean, for example, one of the truisms that I learned 25 years ago in political science class was that the higher the turnout for an election, the more it favors the Democrats.
Yes.
True?
Mostly true. Democrats tend to have a larger pool of potential voters that don't necessarily turn out in every election. But in 2004 in Ohio, Karl Rove managed to find the existing pool of untapped potential Republican voters and put on a great effort to turn them out, and which is what swung Ohio to George W. Bush and what allowed him to win re-election. And frankly, that surprised most of his political scientists, because it did go against that conventional wisdom. But if you look at elections collectively, a little bit of higher turnout does tend to favor the Democrats. Republicans themselves certainly believe that, which is why they oppose the motor voter bill.
Yeah, we say Rove did that by pushing the anti-gay marriage bill and really pushing it hard. And yeah, that's why, I mean, generally we see Democrats are always in favor of expanding voter registration, making it easier to register to vote. Anything making it easier for people to actually get to the polls on election day, whereas Republicans want to keep those numbers down.
Generally, right. But in Ohio, Rove actually managed to find the potential voters. It wasn't just about the issue, but about actually getting them to the poll. Hmm. And they actually had a very efficient team that was picking people up and driving them to the polls so they could vote. I mean, they really went all out in a way that really quite impressive in terms of campaign effectiveness.
And they picked them up in BMWs, I'm guessing?
That I don't know.
I'd be curious to know what the logistics of that were.
Involved.
One of the classic debates among political scientists involves what is frequently called the myth of the rational voter. Mm-hmm. Now, we have volumes of evidence, both anecdotal and scientific, or survey-related at least, that says that the average voter in this country is basically a moron. Abysmally ignorant about practically everything.
Yes, if you test people, they tend to not do well on specifying what issues, where their candidate stands on the issues.
Well, not just that. I mean, you ask them really, really basic things like what's the 4th of July celebrate?
Well,
and they have no clue.
True. Assuming those are particularly relevant to any particular vote, but yes, they tend to be ignorant about things like that. They tend to be ignorant about what's actually in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. Not particularly well-informed set of voters across the board.
A great example, I just saw this a couple weeks ago, was I think, if I'm not positive I got this right, 57% of Americans believed that the TARP bill was passed by Obama.
Saw something along those lines.
When it was actually passed by Bush.
Yes. How quickly we forget.
Yeah, now some political scientists say that this doesn't matter, that even though most individuals know very little about any substantive policy issue, that there's a sort of collective wisdom in the citizenry as a whole. Now, personally, I think that's a steaming crock of nonsense.
You don't believe in the wisdom of crowds theory?
No. What do you think?
I tend to be in agreement with you. I think the collective wisdom of crowds is no more than the assembled, added beliefs of the various different people, and then balance out whoever happens to have the majority, or maybe not the majority, but the strongest incentive to voice their view on it. There's nothing. If you have a bunch of ignorant people, there's no magic that makes their collective wisdom more than the sum of ignorant views.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess to me, you know, the danger here is that so much of what happens in our political system is driven by public opinion polls. So much of the political campaigns, the legislators are constantly making their decisions by reading the tea leaves of these polls. But the polls only measure ignorance. I mean, only a small percentage of those people who are polled have any substantive basis for their opinions. I mean, I laugh when I hear something like, you know, 62% of the American public oppose the president's health care reform bill. And I think, well, you know, number one, I'd like to ask the question of how many of those people tell me what's in the president's health care reform bill. And I doubt you'd find 5% that can name even half the things that are in it.
I'm sure you couldn't. You know, the problem for a politician, of course, is even if you're a good politician who understands the issues and you're not out to in it just for glorification and self-gratification, you may not have the time available and the energy to be able to educate the voters. And your reelection is dependent upon them, regardless of what kind of things they may be thinking. Whether they're intelligent or fools, your reelection depends upon them. So as a politician, if you want to do good, first you have to remain in office. So you have to follow those polls and pay attention to what your constituents believe.
So how do we ever get good policy out of a system like that?
That's the ongoing question in political science and public administration. Essentially, democracy originally was really about controlling the abuse of power, limiting divine right of kings, and so on. And to make that effective for people emotionally or intellectually, that got transformed into the idea that somehow there is a wisdom in the people, which I don't think is particularly demonstrable. Yet that becomes part of our popular belief underlying democracy. The standard alternative to it is the kind of a scientific elite that will make the decisions for us, hopefully dispassionately and disinterestedly, doing just the right thing. But then you are taking control out of the hands of the people who are affected by those policies, and that becomes a very, very difficult thing in terms of political theory. Is there a real solution for it? I don't think so.
Yeah, no, I'm not really suggesting a solution here.
I think we're stuck with the problem of human nature.
Yeah, well, I mean, Churchill famously said democracy is the worst form of government except for all of the alternatives. But I cringe when I hear a politician invoke the wisdom of the people, you know, because the bottom line
it's a good stance to take for a politician. But
yeah.
But it's not substantively true. Yeah.
H.L. Mencken was right. No one has ever gone broke underestimating the intelligence of the American people, nor has anyone ever lost public office that way.
Correct.
But do you think, is it even possible to change this? I mean, I hear people say, well, we need a better educational system. We need better civics education. I'm not sure that even works. I'm not sure that it's even possible to change that.
Those things might help at the margin, but I think really we can't change it. Our only hope is to ameliorate the effects by constraining the types of things our government can do. If we limit their powers to policies that aren't crucially important in a way, you know, that's why we have a constitution that says, well, you cannot make policies restricting our freedom of speech. You cannot engage in cruel and unusual punishment. How far should we limit the authority of government, of course, then is the ongoing question. What are really important policies? From my perspective, economic policies are very important, but they don't have the substantive importance of saying allowing slavery or suppression of freedom of speech and freedom of religion.
Yeah, and I guess I think what you hit upon is a very important distinction, perhaps between democracy and liberty,
yeah,
which is something I'm very big on, and I think people don't realize that the founding fathers weren't particularly big fans of democracy,
not true
as
democracy,
such,
no.
And that the whole point of the Constitution was to limit what democratic majorities could do.
Right. In Federalist Number 10, James Madison makes that very clear. He says in a pure majoritarian system, there is no protection for the unpopular minority. Whereas if you have a system where, in fact, the minority can have a big role, well, if they go out of hand, they can always be outvoted by the majority.
And aren't we seeing just a textbook example of this with this New York City mosque?
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Just an absolute poster child for why they put the First Amendment in there.
Correct.
Understanding that majorities would immediately violate the rights of minorities if they had the power.
Yes. And in any society you can look at, there are subsets of people that constitute a minority. There may not be a permanent minority on all issues, but for every issue there is a minority. And for many issues is a very unpopular minority, such as Muslims in the United States today.
Yeah. I think this is exactly what's gotten me thinking about this issue so much lately, and what made me want to invite you on the show to talk about this, is that this mosque thing, I'm angry. I mean, this really just has me fired up. And it's at least partly because, we're seeing this really rank demagoguery going on. And that wouldn't be so bad if it didn't work. That's what really galls me about it, is that it works.
A demagogue that nobody paid attention to would be nothing to fear, correct?
Exactly.
And I'm like you. This does make me angry. It's gone to a point that I had never quite imagined before, where people are claiming, no, Islam is not a religion,
yeah.
So the First Amendment doesn't apply.
Yeah. There's crazy arguments we're hearing.
It does get to the point of being somewhat frightening, because they're completely trying to delegitimate the very existence of Muslims.
Right.
And that, of course, is the kind of standard tactic and first move of any totalitarian system.
And you have a particular perspective on this, because I know you and I have talked about this before. One of your good friends and a mentor to you,
mm-hmm.
is Mukhtadar Khan.
Correct.
Who's the head of the Center for Islam and Democracy.
Yes.
A strongly pro-Western Muslim.
Yes. Very moderate in his views. Very, very convinced that Islam and democracy, a Republican form of government, can coexist.
Yeah, and he spent basically his entire career sort of building this common ground and trying to convince, Muslims of this, and trying to convince Americans of this as well.
Yeah.
And Muslim Americans.
Yeah.
And yet, to listen to the right wing on this, he doesn't exist.
He either doesn't exist or he's lying.
Yeah.
Trying to fool us and lull us into false sense of security. And there's no effective counter-argument to that.
Right.
When somebody has decided you either don't exist or your existence is a fraud, you can't prove that it's not.
Well, it's like a conspiracy theory. Everything gets sublimated to the theory. No matter, anything gets filtered right through
exactly.
The conspiracy.
All counter-evidence actually becomes evidence in favor of it.
Exactly. And, even when it's not a matter of sort of bias like that and violations of rights, the evidence for irrationality among voters, I sent you this study a few weeks ago. It was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that found that elections can be determined by factors that have nothing to do with the issues at all. The study found, quote, clear evidence that the successes and failures of the local college football team before election day significantly influenced the electoral prospects of the incumbent party, suggesting that voters reward and punish incumbents for changes in their well-being totally unrelated to government performance.
Yes.
Now, I don't have the background to evaluate sort of the methodology of that study. You do, which is why I had sent you a copy of it. I mean, do you think it was a solid study?
It's a very solid study.
Okay.
First, what they did is look at a number of elections between 1964 and 2008, where they could look at the county-level election results, and they chose counties where there was a university with a football team. And then they compared those by analyzing whether the team won or lost or didn't play. And so they have enough data points there to have a good statistical study. Then they followed that up with an experiment done during the NCAA basketball tournament, where they just kind of, they gauged people's approval ratings of Barack Obama, which were influenced by whether their team had won or lost. So finding both historical statistical data and then doing experimental study to follow that up makes for a very, very strong study. I'm quite persuaded.
Well, the Obama link, that's perfectly convincing. He plays basketball. There's a clear connection, right?
Yes.
So but, football maybe with the Kennedys. They played a lot of football.
Whether my team wins or loses should not affect my approval rating of Obama as a president. regardless of how well he plays basketball, right?
Well, you know, I've said for a long time that my sort of theory of how elections operate is that you have a certain number of people that are just going to be slaves to the party, probably 30-35% on both sides. 30-35% is going to vote Republican no matter what. 30-35% is going to vote Democratic no matter what.
Somewhere in that range, yes.
And you've got the people in the middle, and the people in the middle float back and forth. And some of those people make sort of rational decisions. They really study the issues and they and understand them well and come to a reasonable conclusion, mm-hmm. at least through some process of application of reason. But I think most of those people who are sort of shifters in the middle, it's they base their vote on something much more vague.
Yes.
And that is sort of these feelings of, how do I feel? Do I feel secure? And then most of that revolves around, you know, do I have a good job? Do I feel safe in that job?
Well, and this is why the state of the economy really matters in elections, even regardless of whether someone's own job is at stake. Even if you feel relatively secure in your job, of course, you're more likely to vote for the incumbent if you're relatively secure than if you're not. But even so, if the economy is declining or struggling, even those who are secure in their jobs have an enhanced tendency to vote for the challenging party. So there's a kind of generalized sense of well-being that plays a big role in how we view the current political status quo.
Right. Well, I think you know,
but we would think that would relate to things that matter, like the economy, although I always argue that we shouldn't judge presidents on the economy since it's precious little they can do. But this study shows that potentially anything that enhances your sense of well-being can affect your vote, which tells me incumbent politicians should start handing out Xanax a few days before the election if they want to get reelected.
Yeah, we'll have Xanax in the water supply in no time. But yeah, I mean, the irrationality of all of this is that there is rarely very little connection really between what the president controls and what goes on in the economy. I mean, they all pretend to, you know, I'm going to fix the economy.
Right.
And as a result, we all give them all the blame for the credit, even though they don't deserve it.
Right.
I mean, monetary policy has a far bigger impact on particularly short-term economic growth.
I agree.
And yet right now we're in a position where monetary policy is dead for all practical purposes. The Fed's got no bullets in its gun. You know, because the interest rates are at zero for all practical purposes.
Right.
So they can't really do anything to prime the pump. And so we're all kind of stuck in this bad economy. And there is almost nothing Obama can do about it in the short run, is there?
No. There's absolutely nothing he can do about it in the short run.
And yet he's going to get all of the credit or blame.
Yes. And right now it's all the blame.
Right.
So, I mean, it's unfair. But of course, if it recovers, he will take all the credit, so the unfairness kind of balances out.
Right, but the problem for me is that there's no connection to any sort of rational analysis here.
Right, and yet people will make their judgments about, well, coming up in a couple months, a lot of what people will be making their judgments about when they go to the polls is the state of the economy.
Sure,
and of course we'll be into football season, so that may have a role to play too.
Switching subjects here for a bit. One of the things that you and I have in common is that we often refer to ourselves as at least libertarian-minded.
Yeah.
I tend to call myself a left-wing libertarian, and by that I typically mean that I'm when it comes to being a civil libertarian, I'm there completely. But I'm not generally in favor of eliminating government regulation of things that markets don't control well, like pollution.
Right.
Is that generally sort of where you see yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, on civil liberties issues, I am very hardcore. On economic issues, I probably am more libertarian than you are, but as you phrased it there, those things markets can't control well, like pollution, economists call negative externalities, and there I am supportive of government regulation, although recognizing that government regulation can end up just as bad as the poor market outcomes at times. There's no magic bullet in regulation.
Explain the concept of negative externalities. I think that's really a key to this discussion.
Well, in a perfect market theory, every cost of my business activity is accounted for internally. It goes onto my balance book. But if I could push those costs off on somebody else while still taking in the same income, then I'm better off. So if I produce waste in my processes, a perfect market, I would be paying for the cost of treating or storing that waste in a responsible manner. But hey, if I can just dump it out into the river or shoot it up the smokestack out into the sky, then I don't have to pay that cost. But the cost doesn't disappear. Somebody else is suffering that cost. For example, in Monroe, Michigan, there's a big Ford auto plant. And some years back, they had a leaky pipe that caused a major, major contamination of PCBs in the River Raisin, right where it goes into Lake Erie. Well, ultimately, they were forced to do a lot of cleanup there. They're going to be doing some more cleanup soon. They're now being forced to internalize the cost of that pollution. But until now, anybody who wants to swim in that river or fish from that river or take water from that river is having to pay the cost associated with that pollution. And negative externalities are things markets don't constrain very well. And so we need some other method there besides just pure competition at the market, and that's where government does have an important role to play.
And here I think, and this is where I think liberals can learn something from libertarians about how markets operate. And yeah. I think sometimes what happens is, you know, we liberals hear conservatives extol the virtues of the free market in such sort of inflated, almost magical terms that we sometimes go too far in the other direction and just dismiss all talk of what good markets can do. But when markets are operating at their best, with lots of competition among participants in the market, it's a very good thing for consumers.
Absolutely. And ultimately, from the economist's perspective, it's all about the consumers. It's all about having goods and services available, quality goods and services at good prices. And businesses competing against each other for my business can lead to that. I have to increase the quality of my product in order to win customers back, or I have to lower the price of my product to win customers back. And this is where, you know, I've always objected to the confluence of libertarians with conservatives, because I believe conservatives are too authoritarian-minded for libertarians to really be comfortable with them. On the other side, with this kind of developing concept of libertarianism, the linkage between liberals and libertarians, I think the big stumbling block is that concept of the market. It's not the private sector per se that liberals oppose, because they like nonprofit organizations quite a bit, but it's those organizations in the private sector that are motivated by the profit motive that liberals don't trust.
Yeah, and it's okay not to trust them, I think. But
right,
the competition helps restrain some.
And in fact, I'll often say that I don't trust them, but I think that the competition from other like-minded individuals can impose some constraints and rigor on them.
Right.
It's the assumption that it will go bad, it must go bad, that these constraints through competition don't exist is where the real break point, I think, between liberals and libertarians on the economic issues are.
Yeah, and I think this is where I think liberals could learn something from libertarians about the importance of real competition and the good that markets can do. Not because that means we shouldn't regulate markets at all, but because it will help us design regulations that will enhance the good things about markets and reduce the bad things. And particularly it will enhance competition rather than decrease it. At the very least, we could avoid rent-seeking, which is a very important concept in libertarianism. And
yes.
Go ahead and explain what rent-seeking is.
In the few minutes we have left.
Yes, please.
Okay.
30 seconds.
Right. Well, the concept of rent is kind of an unearned payment. And rent-seeking is that attempt to get some payments that you can't get in a competitive market. And if you can't get in a competitive market, then you have to either make the market uncompetitive through government regulation, or just have the government shift that wealth to you directly. And we see this going on perpetually, because businesses, for all their engagement in the free market, businessmen don't tend to like the free market,
right?
Because it's tough for them. So, for example, we used to have regulations restricting the importation of automobiles. Oh, that was to prevent a really competitive market in automobiles in the United States. It was rent-seeking by Detroit's Big Three. And right now we still have, despite our NAFTA and CAFTA agreements, we still have restrictions on the import of sugar. So that's to protect sugar producers, primarily in Louisiana and in the Florida Everglades, and also at the behest of Archer Daniels Midland, because it makes corn syrup as a sweetener more cost-competitive. And so they're seeking to rig the market against the consumers to suck more money out of it. And that's something that libertarians particularly are appalled by. And I think that's an area where liberals could get on board with libertarians, except to the extent that they might see that as threatening jobs.
Right. I mean, and then we sort of get into that, you know, America first thing. But there are others. I mean, even without looking at foreign competition, there are forms of rent seeking that I think if you explain this to people, they recognize the danger of it. For example, we have all sorts of laws in this country to protect existing companies from competition within their own market. There's a case that Tim Sandifer was involved in up in Oregon where they had a state law that moving companies could actually veto new licenses for new moving companies. That yeah. if you wanted to open up a moving company, you had to go into this application process, and they let the other moving companies that existed vote on whether to give you a license.
Correct.
Well, of course, they're going to say no. That's going to hurt their market share.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
So you're basically what was happening is where you had government regulation designed to decrease competition rather than maintain competition, and that's when you're enhancing the bad things about markets and not enhancing the good things about them.
Right, and there are a lot of examples like that.
Yeah.
For example, the American Bar Association exists largely to administer the bar exam and reduce the number of lawyers. We think we have too many lawyers out there, but because of the bar exam, there's actually fewer. So there's a little less competition than there might be otherwise. A friend of mine in California is a dentist, and when she had to take the California Dental Board, she had 3 days in which she had to do a certain number of procedures to prove she was qualified. If she failed to do those procedures in those 3 days, even if it was because she couldn't find people who needed those particular things, she could never take the California Dental Boards again unless she went back to dental school.
And these are examples of regulations that are essentially they're favored by business.
Yes.
The businesses want these regulations because it helps protect them from an actual market.
You know, I used to be a cab driver in San Francisco, and I learned as a cab driver that the reason we have metered fares is not to protect the public. It's to keep up the fares of cab drivers by making sure people don't bargain with them for the lowest fare possible.
Right.
Now, sometimes if you're clever, you can do that anyway and actually beat the metered fare, but a lot of cab drivers will be very upset by that because they know you're trying to beat their system that protects them.
And so, you know, this is, I think, one of the misconceptions about libertarianism, which is that people think that libertarianism is all about protecting big business.
Right.
When, in fact, libertarians tend to be appalled by all of the corporate welfare that we give to big businesses and the way that big corporations use their power to manipulate the political process to get regulations that benefit them and prevent other companies from challenging them or entering their markets.
Correct. And I think this is another one of the reasons why the linkage between libertarianism and the right wing is so flawed. Because even on the economic issues where they're supposedly more aligned, it's not that close, right? The conservatives tend to favor big business. They tend to favor support for big business despite their talk about small government and free market. And libertarians, of course, like the free market talk but don't like the actual regulations and policies that come out of a conservative government.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I think that libertarianism has more in common with liberalism than it does with conservatism. And I think there should be more cooperation here and more common ground. And you can think of so many issues, freedom of speech, separation of church and state, criminal justice issues like access to DNA evidence and police misconduct, executive power, torture and extraordinary rendition, abortion, gay rights. I mean, the list goes on and on of issues where liberals and libertarians are generally going to agree and conservatives are going to be on the other side. And yet there's this perception among people on the left that libertarianism is a right-wing ideology, and therefore they reject everything about it, when I think there's a lot of common ground here that we can at least get some cooperation going on those issues, don't you?
I do, and I think that historic linkage has to do with the history of when libertarianism became more prominent to the extent it's ever become prominent. But during the Cold War, the overriding issue for everything was we don't want to become communists. And so the left wing is perceived as softer on communism, whereas the right wing was very staunchly anti-communist. And that issue kind of overrode everything, I think, for libertarians, because communists presented the worst, you know, at least in terms of how it was done in Cambodia and China and Soviet Union. Communism was the worst of all possible.
Well, yeah, but even
economically restrictive and destructive of civil rights. So I think that's where that linkage came from.
Except that even there, libertarians generally are isolationists. They generally, I mean, you know, Ayn Rand and Martin and Milton Friedman both were strongly opposed to the Vietnam War. Libertarians have generally been opposed to sort of those neocon foreign adventures abroad and projecting American power abroad. So even there, I think there's
always been different strains within it.
Yes.
There's a tendency by some to see libertarians as monolithic, which they're certainly not.
True.
No large group of people can actually be completely monolithic. For my own part, I'm actually probably more hawkish than the average libertarian. But yes, there is that strain in there. But still, you know, they may not have wanted us to be involved in Vietnam, but they still wanted to ensure that the United States did not face the threat of communism at home.
Certainly true, yeah.
And liberals could be seen, rightly or wrongly, as making that possibility more likely. Well, with the Cold War gone, I think that's when we begin to get the breakdown, especially as the right wing in recent years has become more and more authoritarian, and particularly during the Bush administration became more and more interested in foreign adventuring. I think libertarians really began to reassess that linkage, but they're still trying to figure out. And I agree with you. I mean, I came to libertarianism from a liberal perspective, so I lean more left than right myself. But I think for libertarians, it's a matter of, okay, how far can we go in working with liberals? And liberals, kind of the same thing, how far can we go in working with libertarians? And I think on all those issues you mentioned, there's absolutely common ground. Where the difficulty lies is purely in economic policy, I think.
Well, and even there, I really think that there is some common ground when it comes to regulation, if we could just sort of talk these things out.
There is some.
And we're seeing more and more of this. We're seeing people like Will Wilkinson and Brock Lindsay of the Cato Institute, and even Marcos Melitzis, the founder of Daily Kos,
mm-hmm.
Frequently refers to himself as a libertarian.
Right.
And so we're starting to see some people both on the liberal and libertarian side sort of, broach this subject and try to build some common ground. And I think it's a really healthy thing.
And I hope we see more of that because, from my perspective, even if we can't, as libertarians, get everything we want from liberals, if it came down to a choice between living in a country that had kind of a social democratic system versus a country that had kind of a right-wing authoritarian system, for me, there's really no difficulty in that choice.
No,
certainly not. I'd rather live in the social democracy and argue with the liberals that we ought to relax some of the restrictions rather than to live in a right-wing authoritarian government and try to argue with them that we ought to relax restrictions.
Right. Well, ultimately, the common ground is, I think, should be rejection of authoritarianism. That's where our real common ground should lie.
I agree.
So,
I agree.
James, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate you being here, and we'll see you on the blog.
All right. Thank you very much, Ed.
And we'll be right back after this public service announcements. And welcome back to Declaring Independence. We've got about 6 or 7 minutes left, so let's go through some other issues. What else do we have to talk about, Dave?
Well, a good friend, Orly Tate, back in the news. Yeah, I thought you did. The Supreme Court this week rejected for a second time an appeal by Orly Tate, the attorney for the birther movement, of a $20,000 fine imposed on her for filing frivolous complaints.
Yeah, I love this story. The whole thing cracks me up. She originally submitted this appeal to Clarence Thomas, mm-hmm. who rejected it. And this is just, this particular type of appeal you can submit to a specific Supreme Court justice rather than to the court as a whole, and then they decide whether to forward it on.
Sure.
So she originally submitted this a few weeks ago to Clarence Thomas, who said no, and sent it back.
Which is the most he's ever spoken in court.
Then she submitted it to Samuel Alito. And the tradition is if it gets submitted a second time to a second individual, then they go ahead and send it on to the full court so they can just say no,
right.
Stop asking. You know, it's like a parent going no for, you know, dad said no, mom said no.
Right,
now you don't
right,
have anybody
right.
else left to ask. So the full court rejected it.
Yes.
At this time. And now Tate's has a new conspiracy theory.
She's course.
Actually claiming that the justices may have never seen those documents, that their law clerks got together and decided this without giving them any of the documents.
Oh.
So now she's demanding to see the actual court orders with the signatures of all the justices on them. And of course, if she gets those, then she'll claim that the signatures were forged. Right. I mean, you it's like we were just talking about. You can't win with a conspiracy nut.
Yeah. What I can't understand is how this woman is having a fine imposed on her for frivolous lawsuits. It just doesn't make any sense.
That very rarely happens. But she's gone so far that finally the judge in Georgia just went, I've had enough.
Well, and now she's essentially harassing the Supreme Court, too. Yeah. My gosh. Yeah. $20,000, though. That's a pretty,
it's pretty good fine.
Fine.
Yeah.
Hopefully that'll teach her.
No, it won't.
Not a chance. We also have in the news, and this is striking, Ann Coulter is too gay for the World Net Daily. Ann Coulter has been dropped as the keynote speaker at a major conference put on the World Net Daily because she's giving a speech to a group of gay Republicans as well. She's usually criticized by liberals, but of course this time it's coming from the right.
Yeah, this is another one. I just love this story. I mean, imagine for a moment being so far to the right that Ann Coulter is not right-wing enough for you.
I know it.
I mean, you talk about being out of the lunatic fringe.
Yeah.
And to her credit, you know, Ann Coulter has always laughed off the birther nonsense, and the World Net Daily is the biggest, you know, proponent of that.
Think that would be reason why they wouldn't want to invite her to be the keynote speaker?
They actually are crazier than she is, and there's still plenty of stupid and crazy left at this conference. The other speakers include Alan Keyes.
Stupid and crazy.
Yeah. Gary DeMar, who is an actual Christian Reconstructionist.
Wow.
And Victoria Jackson. So.
Yeah, Victoria Jackson. We were talking about this before the show. I didn't realize that she was a crazy conservative.
Yeah, she's completely nuts.
I did not know that. Yeah. But very funny. No.
Yeah.
No,
not at okay.
All. Next. Last but not least, sad news. Dr. Laura is ending her radio show. Sad news to me because it didn't happen 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think good riddance is the phrase that immediately comes to mind. And all this happened because last week she had this big rant where she used the N-word like 11 times, I think, in the course of this thing. But what cracks me up about this is the reaction to it. Sarah Palin on her Twitter account claimed that Dr. Laura ended her show, quote, because her First Amendment rights cease to exist thanks to activists trying to silence her.
Oh, I believe Dr. Laura is saying similar things
she
now
said
as
the
well.
Same thing. Yep. Yeah, she said on the Larry King show that she was quitting so she could regain her First Amendment rights.
Yeah.
But so she never lost those rights.
No.
And in fact, she herself said, listen, this is my choice. I wasn't getting any pressure from Clear Channel,
which
syndicator.
I don't think is true.
May or may not be. But, you know, she says, listen, I made this choice on my own.
Yeah.
Nobody pressured me to do it. So where's the First Amendment? First of all, if Clear Channel had.
Yeah.
The First Amendment constrains what the government,
says
do.
You can, yep.
It doesn't constrain what corporations can do.
Right.
It doesn't constrain what your boss can tell you to do while you're on the job.
Yes.
I mean, I'm a free speech absolutist.
Sure,
totally.
Me too.
First Amendment to the core.
Definitely.
And if the government did anything to publish Dr. Laura for what she said, I would be the first one to defend her.
Yes.
But the First Amendment doesn't mean that others don't get to criticize you when you say something stupid.
And when you're a radio personality for a large corporation and you're not putting forth the kind of message that they want, they can fire you.
Yes,
they can fire you for being racist.
Yes, they can.
The government can't. The corporation can't.
But this is Clear Channel, so that's not likely to happen.
Yes.
But the thing is, I mean, you and I were discussing this earlier, but like the whole N-word rant.
Yeah.
That doesn't even rank in the top 20 crazy, stupid things this woman has said.
No.
Like I wasn't even terribly offended by. Like there's way more offensive things that she said.
Yeah, I mean, going back 10 years, she was calling homosexuality an abomination, and you know, and she stayed on the air.
Right.
And it's now.
And that's fine. You have to, you know, like I said,
she can say it.
Say it on the air. Government shouldn't do anything.
Yes.
The whole thing is just crazy. We need to wrap up now. I'd like to thank James Hanley for being on the show. I'd like to thank Dave Fletcher for filling in so well for Jeremy. And as usual, we end with a long distance dedication. We just mentioned Orly Tate, the crackpot attorney who has filed a million lawsuits seemingly over Obama's birth certificate. Every case, of course, gets dismissed, and now the Supreme Court has turned her down several times. So to her, we dedicate this Motley Crue song, Don't Go Away Mad, Just Go Away.
Girl, don't go away mad. Girl, just go away. Girl, don't go away mad. Now, girl, just go away.
Here we go!
Girl,
Independence is a production of WPRR Reality Radio. Ed Brayton is a fellow of the Center for Independent Media, but views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the Center for Independent Media or its contributors. Technical assistance provided by Jeremy Behan and David Fletcher. To share this program with a friend or catch up on previous episodes, check out the Declaring Independence podcast, available at publicrealityradio.org.